You could have just seen why it was so much fun in that school if I had a student like Esther, now Esther Friedman, then Esther Averstein, as the president of the GO, which I have not forgotten. That was quite a year. And it's a pleasure to see what you have become. I'm going to talk about my father, Rabbi Mordechai Pinchas Teitz, Zichrono Livracha. And I'm just going to tell you one little story at the beginning to give you an idea of the kind of personality and why he was able to accomplish what he did for Jewish life. And because my father's emphasis was always on the future, the whole reason I'm telling you the stories about him is not just a very both loyal and loyal for good reason daughter telling the stories about a very fine parent. It's also for us to take Muster Haskell. It's for us to take some lessons from it about what we might do in our own lives and what we might do for the Jewish community. The story I'd like to start with is a very small one, and I'm going to say the punchline in Yiddish that I'll say in English, so don't get nervous, you'll hear it both ways. My father was very concerned that Orthodox Judaism should be perceived as elegant and as first class. He was very worried when he came to the United States and Canada in the 1930s to find that too often the Orthodox synagogue was in the rundown section of town, the conservative place was in the middle class section, and the reform place was usually in the best neighborhood. And that was the way that people were viewing Judaism as well, that if you were very observant, you were somehow passé and déclassé, but if you were not observing too much, that was considered upper class and very fine. And he wanted to show that should not be the association, and he wanted observing Torah to be associated with elegance. Now, for that reason, he felt that a Jewish wedding should be something very beautiful, very dignified, and done all in the best taste. The most beautiful flowers, the nicest meal, the most lovely venue, everything should be upper class. And he was very concerned that when people started dancing, that the boys not get into the dancing to such an extent that they would get sweated and look sloppy, and especially if they not take off their jackets, which he felt was very much not the thing to do at a dignified wedding. And we all knew that. In fact, my husband had to tell his friends before he and I got married that they should not take off their jackets at the wedding. They had no idea why, but they figured, look, he's a nice kid, he's a good friend, if he asks us not to, they didn't take off their jackets. Well, there was a family wedding, and it was held in Elberon, New Jersey, in a place that was not air-conditioned. The ceremony was outside, but afterward for the dancing, which was inside, it really got quite warm. And some of the boys took their jackets off. It was not one of my parents' own children. It was a cousin's child. So my father was not the one who could go over and say to somebody, you really should put your jacket back on. And my father and my sister are watching the young men dancing, and my father said, look how it looks when they take off the jackets. It's not first class. That's not the way it should be at an observant wedding. And my sister said that sibling rivalry must have been burning bright, and she felt she had to say, you know, one of them is Rivka's son, Yitzi, my son, who had taken off his jacket. So my father looked, and he saw it's a grandson, and he loved his grandchildren. He said, nu, af em cooked the sites edel. On him, which means, well, on him it looks refined. If it's your grandson, even something that's such a major tenet with you looks refined on your own grandchild. Why do I say that? He knew he was making fun of himself, and he knew what he was laughing at. But he had that sense of humor about things, and he felt it was very important that everything in Jewish life, even something that you took very seriously, there should always be a little leavening of a sense of humor. There should always be a little awareness on your part of the irony of things. There should always be a little objectivity on your part, a little bit stepping out and looking at the thing in another light. So, for example, when I came home and told a story that I thought was a really exceptional story, this was a Shabbos when I was already married, about a young woman named Adel Spitz, who was engaged to marry a young man named Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald. You may have heard of his name from National Jewish Outreach. He's the one who does Read Hebrew in 5 Lessons, and he's the one who does Shabbat Across America. Oh, there's a sign there. A Crash Course in Hebrew Reading. That's Rabbi Buchwald. Exactly. That's that Rabbi Buchwald. When they became engaged, Adel Buchwald, whose late father was in diamonds, and who didn't see a diamond as a major thing the way that most of us do, she said, why should we spend $5,000 on the diamond? Instead of getting me an engagement ring, let's give a scholarship for a year to a student in the yeshiva. And that way, that will be a signal of our starting our life together, that we're helping a child to get a Jewish education. I thought that was a magnificent story. And we were at my parents' for Shabbos, and I told this very beautiful story at the Shabbos table. And my father's reaction was, that's a beautiful story. And I am so impressed with Adel and Ephraim Buchwald. That really says a great deal about what idealistic people they are. However, he said, don't tell that to the girls in your high school. I said, why? He said they should want to get engaged. They should look forward to getting engaged. They should look forward to getting the engagement ring. And there shouldn't be even a hint of a thought on their part. Well, if I were only as idealistic as Adel Buchwald, I would say, no, let's give the scholarship to the children instead. Let a person enjoy what they're enjoying. They have a right to enjoy what they're enjoying. And don't even give a little hint of guilt about anything. That was his whole attitude in Jewish life. Enjoy it. Enjoy it in a very full way, in a very complete way. And don't let negative elements, don't let guilt elements, don't let anything of that sort enter into the experience. And that was why he was very concerned that we not take a judgmental attitude toward each other, and then that we not be busy measuring each other's levels of observance, each other's ways of observance. For example, a woman once came to the shul in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where my father became the rabbi, and she was carrying a pocketbook on Shabbos, on Shabbat. And a young man who thought he was doing just the right thing came running over to tell her, no, you don't carry a pocketbook into shul on Shabbat. And she walked out of shul and did not come back again. And then word came to my father that somebody had, quotation marks, taken care of a problem this way. My father went over to the young man and he said, what did you think you were doing when you went over to this woman? He said, well, she was coming into shul with a pocketbook, and I know that that's not the thing to do. You shouldn't be carrying money on Shabbat. You shouldn't be carrying a pocketbook into shul on Shabbat. And my father said to him, yes, so you stopped her from going in, and she turned and she walked out, and now she'll never come back to a synagogue again. He said, if you had let her come in, and if you had welcomed her with a warm good Shabbos or Shabbat Shalom, and let her come in, she would have looked around and she would have seen in the synagogue she's the only woman carrying a pocketbook. And she would have realized, oh, you don't carry on Shabbat. He said she didn't know it, and what you did by turning her away at the entrance was to stop her from ever coming in and experiencing what the service is like, what the beautiful singing is like, what the sense of being part of the Jewish community is like. So he said, you think you accomplished something good, but actually you prevented something good from happening. And that was the entire approach he took. Let Judaism be livable. Let Judaism be positive. Let people come to it. Later on, people can learn all the nuances. Later on, people can learn all the halakha, all the ways that a Jew observes the Torah. But if you take away the chance of starting, how will it ever reach that point? He had two very good models he had a number of good models, but two that he spoke about in particular. One was a relative, and one was a person who was a member of the Latvian parliament. The relative was a man named Rabbi Eliyahu Akiva Rabinovich. It was his uncle, his father's older brother. He was the rabbi in Poltava in Russia. And my grandparents had to flee Latvia, where my father was born, during the First World War. The same way now that the Jew is always the one who's suspect, we're Am Levavad Yishkon, we're a nation that dwells alone. So during World War I, in the different towns where the Germans and the Russians were fighting, each side was suspicious that the Jews would help the other side. So what did they do? They took the rabbi in each town as hostage. They would imprison him. And that way, if any Jew were caught helping the other side, the rabbi was going to be executed. This was a way of keeping the Jewish population in line. Rabbi Eliyahu Akiva Rabinovich, grandfather's brother, heard that this is what was happening in Latvia, and he sent a telegram from Poltava, which was in the Ukraine, to the town in Latvia where my grandfather was, to Subat, telling him that he must flee immediately because he hears that the rabbis are going to be arrested. Thank God my grandfather fled with the entire family. They went to Poltava to stay there for the duration of World War I. They stayed there in the end from 1914 till past World War I. They stayed there till 1921. And that saved the family's lives. And they found out afterwards that the soldiers had come to arrest my grandfather the night after he and my grandmother left with their children. What did he see in this Rabbi Eliyahu Akiva Poltava? He saw a person who had tremendous energy, who had a very warm heart, and who had a very creative way about him. So, for example, there were Hebrew journals at the time, but they took a very anti-religious slant. And he decided, rather than battling these journals, what he would do instead is to create a Hebrew journal of his own. He created a journal called Hapeles. And again, this emphasis on doing everything the first-class way, he went to Warsaw to buy the printing press, and he would oversee the setting of the type himself. He wanted it to come without any mistakes. He felt it was very important that it be done in beautiful Hebrew, it be done in beautiful printing, the best technology. And for 6 years, he put out a monthly journal. which surprised people because it was on such a high level and was so sophisticated and was so well written that it attracted a tremendous readership and became a topic of discussion. Later on, he founded a weekly called Hamodia, and the newspaper that's called Hamodia now is very different from the newspaper that he founded, but they did take the name and they were an offshoot from the Hamodia that he founded. And my father felt that the lesson he could take from Rabbi Yeho Akiva Poltava, from Rabbi Yeho Akiva, the rabbi of Poltava, this uncle of his, who's, as I say, his last name was Rabinovich, was that one person can accomplish a great deal if he's creative, if he's energetic, if he's original, and if he pays no attention to criticism. And I'll give you, which is the most important part, I'll give you an idea of how his attitude to criticism was. Rabbi Yeho Akiva wrote this, and it's such a wonderful expression. He said, when you're reviewing a book, how wonderful for a book it is if you could say, I only found one mistake in it. And how terrible it is for a book if you can only say, I only found one good thing to recommend it. So his attitude was, people will find the one mistake. Go ahead, do your best, be energetic, be creative. Now, I mentioned that his name was Rabinovich, and I told you, and I mentioned that my father's name was Tait. This was a very Russian thing, and if you know people who tried to avoid the draft in Tsarist Russia, you may know about these different rules. One of the rules was that if a person was an only child, he would not be drafted. And of course, every parent wanted to avoid the child being drafted in the army. The recruits were treated terribly. They were treated very cruelly. They were taken in at 12 years old and permitted to go out at 25 if they managed to survive until 25 and came out alive. And it was really virtually a death sentence. So the family, my great-grandparents, managed to find the papers of a young man named Tites who had unfortunately passed away young, but his parents had not reported the death to the Tsarist government. That way, my grandfather was able to go through life with the name Tites and was able to produce papers and a passport. You had to have an internal passport in Russia. So he had everything under the name Yakov Tites, and this is what he used for the rest of his life. And he did not change the name back at the end when he made it to the United States, and already did not have to worry about being impressed into the Tsarist government or being imprisoned for anything. This name had saved his life, so he kept the name. But that's why I know that I'm not related to a single Tites that anybody knows, because it was never really the family name. The family name was Rabinovich. The other person he was very impressed by was a man named Mordechai Dubin, who was a member of the Latvian parliament. He was a very energetic man, and he did favors for everybody. He did favors for non-Jews. He did favors for Jews. My father said that his epitaph should be, this man did more favors than any other human being who ever lived, because that was just his nature. He was a good person, and he couldn't resist doing a favor for another person. He was that kind of a good person. And my father worked with him on some of his political campaigns and was often deputized by this Mordechai Dubin to meet great people who either were leaving Russia or were traveling through Latvia for one reason or another. And he felt it was a wonderful introduction both to a great personality and to a whole array of people that it was just wonderful to get to know. To give you an idea of how passionate Mordechai Dubin was, he loved the prayer called Nishmas that we say on Shabbos and on Yom Tov in the morning. And it is a beautiful prayer about the soul of every living being praising God. And it's really sheer poetry. If our mouths were as full of song as the ocean, we still wouldn't be able to praise God sufficiently. Mordechai Dubin was so moved by this that he would take half an hour to say this because he just wanted to say every word carefully and savor every word. And when he was the one who led davening, everybody knew you were in for a half hour just for Nishmas. So one day they came to shul, and the shul was cold. The fire had gone out overnight on Friday night. And people said, maybe we shouldn't daven here. Maybe we should go to another shul. And Mordechai Dubin said, what are you worried about? It's Shabbos morning. We'll daven Nishmas. We'll all turn warm. Because that was the way that he got so enthused about Nishmas, he felt everybody else could warm up with it. Another place where he learned a very important lesson was the yeshiva that's referred to as Slabodka. Slabodka is actually the name of a suburb of Kovno. And if you look at a map of Russia today, or of Lithuania today, you'll find it listed as Kaunas, K-A-U-N-A-S. But Jews called it Kovno, and they called the suburb Slabodka. This had a succession of yeshivos in it, but always a very fine yeshiva. And the essence of things at Slabodka was very much the emphasis on Kvod Ha'agam, that each person has enormous dignity, each person has tremendous potential, and everyone should try to realize his own creativity and his own potential. This meant respect for every human being that you met, and it meant a tremendous opening up of personality and character in a place that expected exactly that to happen to you. Interesting that in Slabodka, everyone was expected to read a serious newspaper every day, and everyone was expected to dress in a way that would command a positive feeling. The Alter from Slabodka, the person who was venerated in Slabodka, Alter means the old person, but it was really the venerable person from Slabodka, who was the head of the yeshiva. He was the central focus of the yeshiva, I should say. There were other people who had the title Rosh Yeshiva, but this was the famous person. He said, if you have a spot on your clothing, if you don't have a proper crease in your slacks, from that contempt will travel from the person who represents the message of Torah to the Torah. So he felt that every representative of Torah had to have a certain demeanor, a certain beauty about the way that he conducted himself, dressed himself, carried himself to get the beauty of Torah across to people. And here he also learned from seeing how the people in Slabodka sent young men out to other communities to found yeshivos and to try to promote Torah study, the most important thing that you can do is not to bemoan a situation. Bemoaning is the easy part. The important thing to do is to assess the situation, to analyze the situation, and to think creatively. You'll notice that word keeps coming up, creatively, because that was a very important component. And my father always used to quote a Russian general who said, no matter how bad the situation is on the battlefield, the victory will go to the general who assesses the situation and then plans a strategy. And he felt a strategy was the critical element. So, for example, when he came to this country in 1933, together with Rabbi Elia Meir Bloch of Tel Yeshiva, to give a lecture tour across the United States and across Canada, he was in Toronto and Montreal back in 1933 when there were already very strong Jewish communities in both cities. And imagine, it was 1933, 1934 that he and Rabbi Bloch made this trip. And to give you an idea of how Jews care for each other, that was the worst part of the Depression. And yet, when Rabbi Bloch raised money for Tel Yeshiva, people gave money even at that time. My father didn't go as the fundraiser. He went as the speaker. Rabbi Bloch was doing the fundraising. But meanwhile, he got to see many communities. They were in one community, and there was definitely a breakdown in communication because they were speaking Yiddish. Yes, there was a Yiddish-speaking element they could speak to, but the younger generation spoke English. And a young man drove them around to the different places where they were speaking, and at the end of the day, he wanted to express, I'm with you, I'm part of your group, but I don't have any Yiddish to express it with. So he took my father's hand, he took Rabbi Bloch's hand, he shook each of their hands, and he said, Rabbis, Mazel Tov, because that was the only expression that he knew. And my father said, in that Mazel Tov, he heard such a longing to be part of the tradition and to want to know more of the tradition. And here were the only two Hebrew words he knew, just Mazel Tov. I mean, thank God that those were the words he knew, that it was happy words, but that's all he knew. But my father felt from this, what you had to do was establish a way to communicate in this country and to befriend and to educate. And he decided that that's what he would do here. Through a very good turn of fortune, my parents met each other. The truth is that people felt they were destined for each other because my grandfather had passed away in 1933, a month before my father came to the United States, and my grandfather had been the rabbi in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And he had left a will that if the person who married my mother was the oldest child, if the person who married my mother would be suitable to it and would have the proper credentials, that person should become the rabbi after him. And to give you an idea of how kind people were to each other and how cooperative people were to each other, there were two rabbis, Rabbi Eliezer Silver and a Rabbi Feivelson, who agreed to answer all the halacha questions, all the questions of Jewish law that would come up in the community, and to do all the checking of hashkachos, of supervision of kosher products that my grandfather had done, until it would be found out whether my mother would marry the man who would become rabbi or whether someone else would get the position. But they were willing to give of their time, their effort, their traveling to take care of the rabbi and Elizabeth during that interim period, which is, I think, just a beautiful instance of cooperation. And my mother was told, oh, there's a young man who came with Rabbi Bloch, and he's perfect for you. And my father was told, oh, Rabbi Prill passed away, and he had studied in Tells, and he left a daughter who's perfect for you. They absolutely didn't want to meet each other because they felt everybody's taking care of everything. We have no part in this. And people are only thinking about the succession of the rabbin and Elizabeth. Forget it. They would not meet each other. Then, my father came in November. In June, they accidentally met and fortunately met. I don't know if it was a wedding or a banquet, but they started talking with each other, each one without realizing at first, this is the person everybody is saying that I must meet. By the time they were talking to each other and found out each other's names and found out that, well, maybe it's not so bad to meet this person. And in the end, it was a love match. And thank God that my father took the position because he saved his own life and ultimately the lives of his parents and four of his siblings as a result, and a number of other people as a result of being in the United States. But he carried, in fact, when we said, because my father was so determined to learn English and so determined to speak in English and communicate with people in North America, he set about learning English immediately. And, of course, being a Slabodka graduate, the first newspaper he wanted to read was the New York Times. He wasn't going to read any little Elizabeth Daily Journal or something like that. He wanted it to be the New York Times. And he read Shakespeare and Milton with my mother because he said, if I'm going to learn a language, I want to read the best that was written in that language. So he read several Shakespearean plays and a number of Milton poems as his introduction to the language. When I said to my mother in later years how lucky it was that you knew Yiddish, she said, oh no, for Papa it was much more important that I knew English because that way she could teach him English. His first speeches, before he could read English well, and he explained to us, you have no idea how confusing O-U-G-H is to a person from another language learning English. Is it through? Is it though? Is it rough? It's certainly rough. It's certainly tough to learn how to pronounce this. So my mother would hear my father's talk in Yiddish, then she would write it in English, and then she would transliterate it into Hebrew letters so that when he was reading, he shouldn't stumble by getting caught on an O-U-G-H, not being sure how to pronounce it. But he learned English very quickly and started to educate the community. His feeling always was that if people had knowledge, they would definitely want to keep the halacha. They would definitely want to keep Jewish law. The problem was that the vast majority of Jews in America had lost all connections to Jewish knowledge. What had been part of a society and part of an atmosphere in Europe got lost in this country, and now you had many people growing up without any idea of what was in the Torah, not knowing how to read Hebrew, not having a clue to what their being Jewish meant. And one example came up immediately, and this always comes up that in the first few weeks when a person takes a new rabbinic position, there's always a major sensitive question in Jewish law that comes up that has to be dealt with immediately. And for my father, it was that the committee in charge of the cemetery, the Chevra Kadisha, the people in charge of taking care of burials, came to tell him that there was a very, very important man in town who owned the major department store, and he and his wife were the social leaders of the town. And he was building a mausoleum for his brother, who had passed away in the flu epidemic back in 1917, 1918. And he felt that this was to honor his brother. And really, we're not supposed to have mausoleums. In Jewish law, we're not supposed to have burial above ground. He shouldn't be removing his brother from the place where the brother had already been buried in the ground to put him into the mausoleum. There were many violations of Jewish law that were about to happen here. But during the year after my grandfather had passed away, people had had a hesitation about telling Mr. I can say his name because it's a beautiful ending to the story, telling Mr. Milton Levy not to do something. And they had let the construction of the mausoleum proceed, but now it was supposed to be the disinterment of the body from the original grave to go into the mausoleum, all of this violations of Jewish law. And my father asked my mother, is Mr. Levy an erlich person? Is he an honorable person? My mother said, he's an extremely honorable person. That was all that my father had to hear. He took the different halachos, the different Jewish laws, and together with my mother, translated them into English. Then he asked Mr. Levy if they can meet together. And he just showed him the sources, showing that really it's not only not an honor to take a body out of the ground, it's a dishonor to remove a body from the ground. By the time they had finished going through it, Mr. Levy said, of course I won't do it. And he stopped the building of the mausoleum. And here he was a man who had come originally from an Orthodox home, who had joined the conservative group in Elizabeth. And he said, in fact, I'm moving back to membership in the Orthodox synagogue because he was so pleased to have things explained to him and to have his intelligence valued and let him make the decision accordingly. And this was how my father proceeded, to build a mikveh, to build a school, always with start from Aleph Beis, start from the beginning. In fact, a course he always gave in adult education was the geography of the sitter, because he felt that many people don't know how the prayer book is constructed and have no idea of what the davening means and don't even know why we take three steps back, why we bow when we do, why we take three steps forward. And he felt that if people could have things explained to them, then the whole davening both would become more meaningful and would become more welcoming. And I know I became very aware of this when I had a teacher, I'll just mention to Esther, Mrs. Vorsheimer, who loved opera and who was going to go to a wonderful Pavarotti performance that was going to be broadcast on television. And she had very good seats, and she told all of us on the staff at school we should watch the performance that night on television and see if we see her, if she shows up on the screen. So I liked Mrs. Vorsheimer very much. I would love to see if she's in the front row for Pavarotti. This is a wonderful thing. Except the fact that I have a son who's a hockey fan, and there was a very important hockey game on that night. So I was allowed to watch the opera during advertisements for the hockey game. So I didn't get to see my friend on the TV screen. And the next day in school, we're all talking, and they start talking about a tenor. I didn't hear the word tenor, because maybe then I would have guessed, about a singer named Cheryl Milne. And I don't know anything about opera, and I assumed that Cheryl was C-H-E-R-Y-L and was a woman's name. I said, I didn't hear her last night. But I had just said that I was just watching during the ads on the hockey game. So I said, I guess she wasn't on when I had the opera on. And everybody laughed, and they said, no, it's Cheryl, S-H-E-R-R, and it's a man. And at that moment, I thought to myself, yes, I did feel very stupid in front of the whole group here. We're all sitting in the faculty room having a discussion, and I have just revealed that I don't know who a major tenor is. I have no idea that it's a man, and I think that Cheryl is a woman. And I thought to myself, well, why am I feeling so stupid? I don't know opera. I don't know anything about opera. And then I thought to myself about all the times that my father had said, think how a person feels who walks into shul or comes into any kind of Jewish celebration not knowing what's going on. There is no way you can fault that person because they just weren't exposed to it. And I didn't know that Cheryl was a man, and these people don't know Aleph Beis. And always remember that feeling. At that moment, I knew what he was talking about. And he wanted to make all of Judaism available to every interested person. One of the things he thought, and this is very interesting in light of all the discussion that's going on now, in light of all the money that gets spent on studies and on associations and on grants and on all kinds of things, he thought the main thing was that yeshiva education should be free of charge. He felt that the same way that the public school takes care of every child, that's a government obligation, he thought it was a Jewish communal obligation to see to it that every child should get an education. And instead of spending all the money that we do on all kinds of things, he felt plain spoken one need. And every time he did an experiment, it turned out to prove that this was correct. First, he persuaded the Board of Trustees to give Talmud Torah free of charge. That was just the afternoon school. And suddenly, 70 kids appeared for Talmud Torah that nobody even knew were living in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And the Board of Trustees was stunned because it's a small Jewish community, maybe 10,000 Jews, and here 70 kids that nobody had ever even known existed were Jewish and living in town. The next experiment he tried, once that experiment worked, was that any family that wanted to send a child to yeshiva for a year as an experiment, who had never sent a child to yeshiva before, they have free tuition at the yeshiva in Elizabeth for that first year. And again, a number of people showed up. So he felt that both of these things proved that money was an obstacle to people getting yeshiva education. And since he thought that we should be making yeshiva education available from the time the kids are 3 or 4 years old all the way up, he couldn't understand the community allocating money to anything else before putting it into Jewish education. And he and another person were known as the two soft touches in the United States when it came to scholarships. The other man was Rabbi David Silver in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who's also famous for let the kid come. I don't care whether the parents understand or not. I want the child to get the Jewish education. And they both felt, and I interviewed them both at the end of their lives. I interviewed Rabbi Silver when he was already in his 90s, and I asked my father in his 80s, did you ever regret a single scholarship that you gave? And they said, no, because even if the parents didn't understand, or even if the parents thought, oh, we conned that rabbi, or we fooled that rabbi, or we scammed the school, he didn't care. He said as long as the child got the education, the child understood, and that was all that mattered. And I think that's something that we could bear in mind. He also felt that we should use every gift of modern communication. So, for example, if there were now records and radio and tapes, that we should be using them to teach Torah. And in fact, it's 50 years since he started it, and I've just been working on this for the past 2 years. He made a program called Daf HaShavua, and you see here on the front cover of this, which I'll pass around, the first broadcast of Daf HaShavua in 1953. Daf HaShavua, the page of the week. He taught Talmud on the radio. He did it on Saturday night because he felt that any other night of the week, a rabbi might be giving shir, might be giving a lecture. But he said on Shabbos afternoon, everybody has taught already, nobody's giving a shir on Saturday night. So he wouldn't be conflicting with any rabbi's teaching. He did it in Yiddish because the crowd that he wanted to reach was the group that had known Yiddish as children and that had some connection to learning when they were younger and had lost that connection. And he felt these are not people who are going to come into the Beis Medrash at this point. They're not going to come into the study hall. But if he could bring the study hall into their living room, they would listen to a program in their living room. A labriot, so gesund. And he improved beyond his greatest expectations to be a tremendous success. And he had it in the New York, New Jersey area, and then in other towns, people in other cities, people asked him to send recordings or tapes. So ultimately it was broadcast in Boston, Philadelphia, Miami, in Montreal, in Toronto for a very short while, in Los Angeles. And later, Kol Tzion LaGala, the voice of Israel that went behind the Iron Curtain, also broadcast the tapes. And how did he get into tapes? Because originally it was on those metal wires. I don't know if you ever saw the metallic tapes. That's from about a long, long time ago. That was the technology. Wire recorders, right. Then it was on reel-to-reel recorders, and then finally on cassette tapes and such. So people would call to ask him, I missed a program, could you send me a copy? That was how Torah tapes began, from that program and people asking for tapes of it. And fortunately, unfortunately for the first Masechta, the first tractate that he taught for Megillah, my father did not think about saving them. He was just so interested in doing something new and something innovative, he wasn't thinking yet about saving them. And certainly he got criticized for doing this also, as Rabbi Kelman knows and quoted yesterday in his talk in shul. People said, how can you teach Gemara on the radio? Maybe somebody who's not Jewish will listen. My father was not worried about a big non-Jewish audience listening to a Yiddish program of Gemara on the radio. But he had to answer that also. And he answered halachically by saying that if people are listening in their living room, it's not exactly broadcasting in the marketplace. Each person is listening privately to the program. So I'll just pass this around for you to see. What I'm doing now is we had many, for the other 8 tractates that he did, the family kept getting requests from people. They wanted to have copies of it. So finally, I did for 3 tractates, moving it from the reel-to-reel original technology. I only had, out of 5 players that my father left behind, I'll just pass around on this side. Only one was left that still worked, and that even that one I treat very delicately, and I go to a special place to have it serviced. It's very, very precious. But I transferred it from that, that technology onto cassettes and CDs. What I find so interesting is who's buying it, that I was going to have people who speak Yiddish buy it, understood. An older generation that speaks Yiddish, or even a younger generation now in certain yeshivas that speak Yiddish. University students. One university student, Brocha Kaplan, at Columbia University, which has a Yiddish department that's progressing very nicely under Professor Jeremy Dauber, she got these tapes. She was fascinated with it. What she loves is that the Yiddish is very sophisticated and very elegant Yiddish without English words in it, and it's a pronunciation she can understand. It's the Litvisha pronunciation, which is a pronunciation that's taught in university departments. She put a notice about it onto a website called Jugendruf, which is Call for the Youth, and another website called Mendela, which I guess is from Mendela Mochersar, I'm not sure. And I am getting orders for a Gemara program in Yiddish from the 1950s from people at the University of Indiana. It absolutely boggles the mind, which just tells you that Torah has a life of its own. I never thought that Yiddish was going to revive. I never thought that there would be a Yiddish book center in Amherst, but this is what's bringing up an interest in it. He had very good approaches about a number of things. For example, just little life things. when he started the different schools, of course each time there was criticism, and of course each time there was, do we really need this? And do we really need an elementary school? We have Talmud Torah. Do we really need a high school? The kids can go to New York. We don't have to have our own high school. Each step was trying to persuade people about doing another original thing. And he used to say, there's an expression in Hebrew, kol hatchalot kashot, all beginnings are difficult. And he said, why should it be all beginnings? It should be every beginning is difficult. Kol hatchalot kashot, it should be in the singular. And he said, no, every time you start something new, it has many beginnings in it. For example, when you start a new relationship, when you start, thank God, a marriage, there's so many things that you have to learn about each other, and so many, it's not just one beginning, it's many beginnings. If you start a new job, so it's learning a new way of relating to people, it's learning what the mores of this particular workplace are, it's many beginnings. Even moving to a new house, it's a new phone system, a new electrical system, so it's kol hatchalot kashot. So you have to be prepared for the fact that there will be many difficulties and many beginnings to the beginning. And just work with it, and eventually it will work through. He was very practical about things to do with personal relationships. For example, about marriage. This was told to me after my father passed away by somebody who had gone to him, somebody who had been divorced and was about to remarry. And my father said to him, look, I'm afraid the mistake you made in your first marriage was that really you felt sorry for the woman, and you felt that you were rescuing her. And I feel that that's why that marriage didn't work, because nobody wants to feel that she's the sorry one in the relationship or that she's being rescued. And I want to be very careful, and I'm going to tell you something that I would not say in other contexts, but only in the context of marriage. He said, in every other part of life, your attitude should be, I want to be the one who gives, and I want to be the one who does more. There's a Yiddish expression for it, go minor, I rebregain. Let mine go over. You want to be the one on the giving end in the relationship. But he said, in marriage, it has to be a partnership. And that's the one time where there has to be an element of selfishness and you're making a decision. You have to ask yourself, do I really feel that life with this person will be something very special? Do I really feel that this is a person that I will be happy with? He said, if you can answer that positively, this is the right person to marry. But if you're doing it again because you feel that you'll be good to her and you'll be good for her, that's not a good way to get married. And when you think about it, it's so true. Nobody likes to feel that they're the lesser one in the relationship. And it has to be, I see you in a very positive light, and I feel that life with you will be something very special. That's the one time to be selfish. I'll just mention now two stories that I didn't put into the book. And in fact, a Hebrew translation has just been done of the book, and I have put one of them in, and I'm still deciding whether to put the other one in. One, again, is a sense of humor in facing a difficult situation. There were a lot of people who opposed kosher slaughter. They masked it under humane society kind of intentions, but very often, as we knew in Switzerland and in Bavaria and in Germany and in Italy, when rules are passed against kosher slaughter, it's not just the animals that are being thought about. It's also, we don't want the Jewish people living in this country, so we're going to make life a little more difficult for them. In the 1950s in the United States, there was a major campaign to outlaw kosher slaughter on the basis of the fact that it was supposed to be not humane. Now, this is really interesting because if you know anything, I guess most people here have not ever been inside a slaughterhouse. I was because when I was about 8 years old, my father left my older sister and me in the car while he went in to check on the slaughterhouse that he was supervising, and he told us, stay here, don't come in, I'll be out in 5 minutes. So, of course, my sister and I decided the 5 minutes were up and we better just check where he was. So we went inside, saw the inside of the slaughterhouse. So, yes, there are animals there and they are making all kinds of bellowing sounds. But the fact happens to be, if you've ever seen the actual act of shechita, the actual act of kosher slaughter of an animal, it is absolutely painless to the animal. You know about the chalaf, you know about the knife, that the knife has to be extremely sharp, so sharp that if a person would cut himself accidentally with it, the person wouldn't even feel the cut because it's so sharp that they would not feel the knife slicing through. And it has to be a certain length, a certain breadth, everything so that when the shochet, when the person who does the slaughtering makes the cut, it will slice right through and slice through the all the conduits to the brain so that the animal immediately has no sensation and feels no pain from the slaughter. I think it's pronounced carotid. It's the carotid artery that has to be severed immediately, and this produces instant anemia of the brain. So my father was very involved in going to the legislatures in New Jersey, New York, and even going to Washington, where incidentally he felt that Senator Hubert Humphrey was a great friend of the Jewish people and is one of the people who protected kosher slaughter and prevented legislation against it. And he got called in the 1980s by a government inspector who knew the part that he had played in promoting kashrut and in keeping kosher slaughterhouses viable, to tell him that there's a kosher slaughterhouse at that time in New Jersey that's really being run in a terrible way. The fellow happened to be an Indian, and I never checked with my father when he told us the story. Did an Indian mean an Indian from American Indians or an Indian from India? It's interesting. You hear the story, you don't think to check at the time. Then after my father passed away, I realized I don't know which kind of Indian he meant. It was an Indian who was the inspector, the state government inspector for one part of the slaughtering process. And he called my father to tell him there's something terrible going on at the slaughterhouse. The lambs are being treated terribly. And he knew that there's an idea in Jewish life that tsar bali chayim, that you're not allowed to cause pain to an animal. He said these lambs are not even being permitted to move. They're packed in so tightly together, they can't even move. He had never seen anything like this in a kosher slaughterhouse. And he said the whole place is just an exercise, he felt, in evil to animals. And he said, you must go and do something about it. So my father took along two shochtim, two people who worked as slaughterers, to be his witnesses, and he went to visit that slaughterhouse. Well, he came in, and there's a Yiddish expression, is a mishkut gavarin. He didn't feel too good when he saw what was going on there. The animals were being kept in the most horrible conditions, definitely against Jewish law to treat animals that way. And then when the fellow who ostensibly was the shochet came to show his chalaf, the fellow who did the slaughtering came to show the knife, it was full of nicks, it was not the proper size, everything about it was being done incorrectly. And the fellow dares to assert, I'm a student of Rav Moshe, that means Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, the great decisor of Jewish law. So my father said, this is a student of Rav Moshe, I'll tell you what he means by that. He means that this young man who's claiming to be a student, he was in kindergarten on the first floor when Rav Moshe Feinstein was giving a lecture on the second floor. That's how he was learning under Rav Moshe. But he said that's the only kind of learning under Rav Moshe he did. There's no way that somebody who had actually had 2 minutes of studying with Rav Moshe could have let animals be kept this way, could have had a chalas, could have had a knife that looked like this. He didn't buy it. So he told the fellow the operation has to close immediately. So then this fellow said, Rabbi, I'll cut you in on a percentage. You can have a percentage and let it keep going. So my father was taken aback and he said, no, this is closing. You can't talk to me about percentages. He was just so taken aback that a person could think that way. And then the fellow let loose with a third comment that was really very frightening, and I'm sorry to say, not unexpected. He said, you know, anybody who reports on what's going on here, we have been warned, is going to end up in the freezer on a weekend with the freezer door closed. It was the mafia that was involved in this, and they knew that there was money to be made in the kosher market. They had taken over this place. They had kicked out anybody who knew anything and left this young man in charge to do what he pleased. So even at a moment like that, with being threatened by the mafia, with being offered a percentage, with the fellow being so corrupted and so foolish, my father could still make a joke. Yeah, he was in kindergarten and Rav Moshe was on the second floor. He studied under Rav Moshe. That was his studying under Rav Moshe. But also the willingness to go, that if he got the phone call from the inspector, he went to the slaughterhouse and went to see for himself. The other story I left out is just an interesting story about how times have changed. When I was in the Yeshiva in Elizabeth, my father felt it was very important that a girl get every bit of education that a boy was getting. So that meant that if the boys started Gemara in the fifth grade, the girls started Gemara in the fifth grade. We all started Gemara together. And I learned Hakoneh Son Ladir when I was in fifth grade, and another parak in sixth grade. And then for seventh grade, I went to public school. The Yeshiva Elizabeth only went through sixth grade at that time. And for eighth grade already, I went to live in Brooklyn with my grandmother in order to attend the yeshiva there, Yeshiva of Crown Heights. When we were given applications for Yeshiva High School, we were told to fill in what we had studied, what Chumash we had studied, what Navi we had studied. And I raised my hand in front of an entire class, and I said, but where do we put down what Gemara we studied? And the girls were horrified. Gemara, girls don't study Gemara. What's the matter with you? So as I have mentioned, I was probably the only 13-year-old in the entire continent who went home for Shabbos and said, I just found out that there are people who think that girls should not study Gemara. And I was stunned by this. Why should a girl not study anything? And my father told me, don't argue this with anybody. He said, I'll just tell you, if this generation is the generation where girls study Gemara, this will be a wonderful generation.
To continue, please go to side 2 and press play.
The change that happens in our time. Of course, since then, I have studied and I have learned that in learned homes in Europe, there were women who knew Gemara, and there were women who did study. And there was even a woman quoted in the Torah Journal in the 1880s, and she was my great-grandmother, for having an analysis of a question that came up and giving a very good analysis. And nobody saw anything wrong with her being quoted in Yagdil Torah, let the Torah be elevated, let the Torah expand. That was the name of the journal. It was just that what used to be for a very small group in a very particular kind of home, on the part of a young woman with a very strong interest that she pursued, is now going to be made available to everybody. I'm very careful to say this is not a revolution that's happening in our time. It's just an opening up of something that had been available only to a small group is now available to anyone who would like to take advantage of it. I'll just say the final thing, and then I'll see if there are any questions. He always used to say that the Torah speaks the language of tomorrow, that very often new events reveal what the Torah actually meant. So, for example, people used to read the account of Joshua leading his troops in battle, and there were military strategists who said, no, a general should not be at the front in the battle. He should be at the back giving the orders. And then in the 67 war, in the Six-Day War, what was one of the reasons that Israel was so successful on the battlefield? Number one, Hashem was making the victory happen. But also, it became famous, the expression at that time, that what the general said was, what the commander said was, Lechu Achrai, come after me. And because they were at the forefront and they took advantage of every opening that he could in the battle, that was a major reason that Israel had such a stunning victory. So he said here was something that was criticized for centuries, and suddenly in 1967 we understood what the Torah was teaching us about Yehoshua. And I often think of that in davening now as I come across different expressions, and I realize how prescient these expressions were and that new events do reveal more meanings in the Torah. For example, every morning when we say the Hallelujahs, there's one wonderful expression in Tehillim Kuf Mem Vav in Psalm 146. We say, Hasam Gvulech Shalom, who makes your border peace. And you think about what's going on right now in the Middle East. Halavai that there would be a border, like the border between the United States and Canada, if we could ever have the wonderful bracha, the wonderful blessing of that kind of border with our neighbors, then that would really be the most wonderful thing. And it's Hasam Gvulech Shalom. We can hope for that to come, that the border should be a border of peace. I brought along something to give each of you, because we made a celebration of the start of giving out the different Masechtos. My father used to dedicate programs in honor of people or in memory of people. And I made a little booklet about some of the dedications just because they're fascinating for what they reveal about the range of the Jewish community. And since I had some extra copies, I brought them along. You're each welcome to take one home and to read it. And I also have copies of the book here. And if there are any questions, I welcome questions.
And one question. Yeah. Points you mentioned your father came in 1950, Rabbi Flossel.
Right.
Now, and then he was 34, and he didn't go back to Europe? That was his permission?
No. He had made a promise to his father. His father had a feeling that he was going to meet somebody and marry her in America.
Really?
Yes. So he made a promise to his father before he left that if he did marry in the United States, he would come back with the bride to visit with his parents and then to make the decision about where to settle. So my parents had a very interesting honeymoon in Latvia and Lithuania, which was not the usual honeymoon destination at the time. And my mother met the family, and they were very much taken with her and approved the marriage and approved my father going back. And in fact, when we say in Az Yashir in the morning, Zekeli ba'anvehu, Elokei Abi v'Ramamenhu, this is my God, and I will praise him, the God of my fathers, and I will exalt him. So you could think it's in the wrong order. After all, first you learn from your parents about God, and then you experience it in your own life. And my father said, no, he knew from his own experience it goes the opposite way. When you experience God's supervision in your own life, then you first understand what your parents were telling you. He did not know when he married my mother what that was going to mean for his life. But he feels that when he looked back, it was Yad Hashem, was the hand of God that made him make this wonderful decision. Then he understood what his parents were telling him about the hand of God in your life, the supervision of God in your life. Yes?
Your father sounds like a centrist in a general term. In today's environment of polarization, where would he have landed?
He would have spoken out so strongly about appreciating each other and about valuing each other. I find it so interesting, even now, I mean, this is a very minor little blip on the screen of Jewish contention, because we have so much contention in Jewish life, but the tape recordings are being done, the copies of the cassettes are being done by a Sotner group in Monroe, New York, and the CDs are being done by a Lubavitch person in Crown Heights. And to me, that's just such a perfect epitome of what my father was all about, because he was friendly with the Lubavitch Rebbe and the Sotner Rebbe at the same time. My father would have said, what's with you? Why is there so much contention, and why is there so much pulling this way? He did worry about one thing, and I'm saying this advisedly. It's something that was told to me privately. I can say it publicly. Once just talking together, he said, why do we blow the shofar holding it to the right? You know that when the shofar, person blowing the shofar, the Baal Tokeya holds the shofar up, he holds it to the right. So I thought, just in general, he's saying, why do we blow the shofar? So I said, it's to confuse the Satan, that Satan should be confused in coming with accusations against the Jewish people. So my father said, no, but why do we hold it to the right? So I didn't know why we hold it to the right. He said, because it's the Satan from the right that's the dangerous one. But I'll tell you why he said, no, but interesting why he said that. I mean, it was just not just a joke. He said, because that's the one that's telling you, you're so pious, you're so good. If only everyone would be like you. And he said, that's the danger. When you're thinking, if I'm so pious, I'm so good, if only everyone would be like me, that's a very dangerous thing. That's why we hold the shofar to the right. So he had enormous respect for anybody who was observing in any way, for anybody who was Jewish, for anybody who was not Jewish. He had tremendous respect for people. But he couldn't understand this movement of not knowing where your customs came from. Just to give one quick example, the fact that we always used to have mixed seating at weddings in the United States until after the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, because at that time a number of Hungarian Jews came to the United States and they brought two things with them. They brought separate seating at events, at happy events, and they brought the desire for glatt meat. That means animals that have smooth lungs instead of animals that have been checked for cirrhosis, for adhesions, to make sure there are no holes in the lungs. But I'm talking about how long. Okay. And my father felt that it was very important that you keep your minhag, that you keep your custom. So he certainly thought that if Hungarian Jews were used to sitting separately, they should have separate seating. But he thought that if you were a Lithuanian Jew or a Latvian Jew or a German Jew or any other, I mean, I'm being very Eurocentric. Maybe, I don't know what it was in North Africa. I don't know what they did in Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, or in Yemen, or in other places where Jews lived. But I'm saying the places where I know, where I learned about from family members who lived there. And my father always used to tell us that at Rav Aaron Cutler's wedding, there was mixed seating. It was a Lithuanian wedding, so it was mixed seating. And in fact, I'm going to get ahead to this afternoon's talk, but he felt that at weddings, we should deliberately have mixed seating for the young men and young women who are not married yet, because it was considered in Latvia and Lithuania the best outcome you could have from a wedding was if another young couple met each other. Yes?
Aren't you being maybe a little overgenerous in the sense of that, but there are different times today, and maybe your father would have responded totally different given the environment. Like, his battle was a whole different battle in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, in terms of what was facing
Jewish, right.
But today the battles are an entirely different field, and he may have veered into a much more yeshivish way of, you know, and certainly you can see that. So
I can't speak for him because he was too much of an original for me to say what he would have thought. But having absorbed the lessons that I took from him, which was what he hoped we would do, and having absorbed a whole way of looking at things, I think his emphasis would have been on, why are we being so contentious? and why are we making Judaism into something rather artificial? He was very much concerned that halakha be observed very properly and very fully in a very genuine way, but not that you add things to it that would make it difficult for the community to keep halakha. Let me give you an example. Again, this is not a...
Yeah. Yeshiva and Elizabeth.
Yes.
Is it mixed?
Now through fourth grade, it's mixed.
And the legacy of Father Schneider?
Exactly, yes. And I'll tell you why. When he started the yeshiva, it was mixed through eighth grade, first through sixth grade, then through eighth grade. He separated it when he had both the number of students and the kind of population with whom he could separate it. But he didn't separate it for the earlier grades, and he didn't cut off complete interaction between the boys and the girls. The girls were welcome to come to the boys' basketball games. Boys were not welcome to come to the girls' basketball games for obvious reasons. But the girls could come to the boys' basketball games. Debates were held together. Different events were held together. Now, let me tell you, for example, in the 1940s, Rav Aaron Cutler came to a Torah Masorah convention, and he wanted to propose that all day schools should be separate across North America for boys and girls. And my father got up, and he said, Kvod the Kletzke Rosh Yeshiva, and he was very respectful and very friendly with Rav Aaron Cutler. He said, we are letting young men who are not married teach in day schools, and we are letting women who are married teach in day schools. Both are things that the Shulchan Aruch says not to do. But he said, we're doing it because Eflasos Lashem, Hefer V'Torah Secha. We've reached a point where the only way we're going to have teachers is if we violate both of these things, and that's why we're letting unmarried young men teach, and that's why we're letting married women teach. So he said that's a clear violation of the Shulchan Aruch. However, he said, separating boys and girls, there's nothing about that in the Shulchan Aruch. That's a geder for tznius. That's just a fence around for modest behavior. So he said, for a fence around modest behavior, what you'll do is you will close the day schools across the United States. He said, New York has enough students to have day school separate for boys and girls. Baltimore has enough students to have day school separate for boys and girls. But he said, if I can tell you anything from Elizabeth and from all the communities in New Jersey, New York, Connecticut that I'm aware of, it's hard enough to start a school. It's hard enough to get parents to register a child in a new school. It's hard enough to raise the money for the school. It's hard enough to get the teachers for the school. It's hard enough to get the building for the school. If we're all going to have to do it now for two schools instead of one school, we can just close the Torah Masorah movement, and we can stop the day school expansion right now. But he said, I will follow whatever the Rosh Yeshiva says. And he took the keys out of his pocket, the keys to the school building, and he said, these are the keys to the school building for the Yeshiva in Elizabeth. If you say it has to be boys and girls separate, I'm giving it to you. You can keep it going. But I know I can't keep it going. And this was from one of the most successful day schools. And Rav Aaron, I won't even say back down. That's not the kind of word I would use about Rav Aaron Cutler. But Rav Aaron recognized the reality, and said, we're not going to make such a rule. Yes, my father got a beautiful letter from Rav Moshe Feinstein congratulating him when he started the Berea High School for Girls, because Rav Moshe was so relieved that it was a separate school for girls and not a co-ed school that my father made in Elizabeth. So he fell from, actually, it's fifth grade and sixth grade, they're still together for English studies, they're separate for Hebrew studies. After that, once the girls turn 12 years old, they're separate completely. But that was something he could have had in mind the whole time. But he didn't believe in this absolute separation of the sexes that we have now, because it's not real. It's not natural. And it's not real life the way it's lived. If we knew anything about what shtetl life was like, and if we knew anything about what European life was like, in a certain way it was a very wholesome life. And Yiddishkeit was very real there, in a way that we've made it very artificial today. And that worried him, the artificiality of it. He was very worried about the artificiality of people being told to rely on Hashem, just rely on God, and not worry about what degrees you're getting to earn a living. He just couldn't understand how you could possibly be so unfair to young people as to tell them a thing like that. And he also pointed out that in Europe, the only people who were supported were an elite of the elite. In the Kollel at Slabodka, among the members were Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rav Yaakov Ruderman. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky later became Rosh Yeshiva Tor V'Das. Rav Yaakov Ruderman founded Neri Yisrael. Very few, 18 members in the whole Kollel, and a limit of 5 years for being in the Kollel. It was not a lifelong thing, being in Kollel. So he was kind of stunned by the change that happened when across the Atlantic, that what had been for an elite and for people who are really going to contribute tremendously to the community, and was for a limited amount of time, became something very different and very artificial. Who ever heard of an artificial class of people who don't have to face real life? And he felt it was going to be detrimental. The fact is, who has been produced by the system we have now that's a shining light? Where do we have a Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky today, and where do we have a Rav Yaakov Ruderman today? Then it was a very focused thing, very focused on the elite and developing the elite. And what we've done now is to make it a very large mass movement, and we don't have any shining lights out of it. So he was very concerned about being real. I can't speak for him. I would want to hear his own approaches today. But he was very worried about this kind of thing. He used to come home from meetings of Rabbanim, and he would say, everyone is afraid of the person who is right, so everyone keeps voting further and further along for things that they may not really believe in if you would get them separately. But everyone is afraid of being found wanting in some respect. He felt Aguda went off the track in that way, that Aguda, which had been found in Europe to cope with all the things that face Jewish life from a Torah point of view, somehow in this country the stationery changed, and in the United States, I don't know what the Canadian Aguda Tisrael says, but in the United States it says, to cope with the problems of the Torah community. That's not what Aguda was founded for, not in Europe. It was founded for the entire community. So yeah, things have changed, but I think we have to analyze what are the changes leading to. I think they're leading to a certain isolation of the religious community from the rest of the Jewish community and a certain artificiality in the Jewish community, and that worries me very much. A little thing that I'm sure nobody else is bothered by, but I know it's a custom that came from out of nowhere. How many of you have stood up when the groom or the bride comes in pardon me, at a wedding now? I think everybody here has. I have. That custom is almost 10 years old. And somehow it spread, and now it's practically halacha. I'm not criticizing it or favoring it or anything. I'm just saying it's interesting to see what customs kind of take off. And
but if you watch in Toronto, yes. They're all sitting down.
Because they know that it's not an old minhag. Right, it's exactly.
Also, there's no halachic requirement for a mechitza or a dancing at a
right, right. And if one wants to make one because one figures that it's new, that's a wonderful thing. But let a person know why he or she is doing it. They should know what the reason is. Yeah. Rabbi, what do you want to say?
Yeah, I just want to mention the first time I met your father, just in response to questions gentlemen, was at a conference of the Educators Council of America.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not your Torah Masorah group.
Right.
He was there to sit in on a session on day school education and so on. And he said some rather enlightening things at the time. I just mentioned that just somebody's asking where he would come down today. It's fascinating. You mentioned about Lubavitch and Sattler being involved in reproducing tapes in terms of his own actual attendance. He was at a meeting of the Educators Council of America.
Right, right. And he valued what everybody was doing. Whatever they're doing, he valued it. Yeah. Okay, I thank you all very much. Esther, go ahead.